Welcome to the El Arpa podcast, the home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk. Train's leaving at 7:30? Yeah. Of course it is. Oh, we're on the podcast again. Oh no. I thought she was leaving at 7:30, you know that?
Yes, I know, but I was just confirming.
Okay, great. So we are in the beautiful Campo de Naciones, the field of nations.
True.
Yeah, there's a guy from Benin over there, another guy from Eritrea, Argentinian behind me. Everybody's just filling out this gap now. So, there's a free train. But before we talk about the free train, you were actually here when this park was first opened.
No, I wasn't here. I just remembered when they put it on the news that they were opening it.
Ah, okay. In 1990, no?
Early 90s. I can't remember exactly, but yeah.
Your dad took you here.
Yes, my dad brought us on a bit of a trip.
It's actually great. If you are visiting Madrid or if you live in Madrid, I would recommend coming to this park because obviously Casa de Campo or Tiro, they have their charm, but also full of tourists and runners and people, puppet shows, and that is great in its own right as well. But this is a bit more
quiet.
Yeah, yeah. There's far less people here. And very beautiful sculptures, kind of funny ones, tongue-in-cheek ones, lots of animals. We saw a turtle. A few ducks, horrible
in
fish.
Water, it wasn't just like walking around. Lots of animals. We saw a turtle.
I saw a turtle at the vending machine getting a bottle of water.
Wow.
It was quite the sight. So here we are as the last podcast of season 5. Then we're going to take a 2-week hiatus. And we'll be back with season 6. It is summer holiday time. So everybody bring your bucket and spade to the beach. Where are you going for your holidays?
North and South.
North and South?
Yes.
That could be anywhere from Iceland to New Zealand.
Just in Spain.
Just in Spain. Okay. And you're going to ask me where I'm going?
You're going home.
I am going to go home.
To your second home.
I'm not going to go home to my first home. Ireland. So, you know, Spanish lady.
Logical order.
You don't have my citizenship or my heart. As a country, even though it's a great place to be, I'm very happy in Spain. But you can take the boy out of Ireland, but you can't take the Ireland out of the boy.
Definitely.
Okay, then. Well, we're going to talk about different things in part 2. So please do enjoy this musical interlude, and we will be back with more of that aforementioned stuff.
Aforementioned stuff.
Welcome to part 2, and Mary, you have a special shout out to Mr. or Mrs. Radio Public.
Well, no, it's just that if you listen to us on Radio Public, you support us doing more of the stuff you like and we like to.
Very excellent, great work. So far it's been all filler, now for the thriller. So you, congratulations, you've been, you're almost on the point of submitting an archaeological article somewhere. Can you tell us more about that exciting news?
Oh yeah, it's just part of the report of the dig that I was in February, and well, I'm just submitting the part to do with Mud Brick.
Okay.
That's it.
And also, you have a website that tells you when people use your, they cite your article.
Yeah.
In their thesis.
Well, academia.edu is like quite a common website for academics. And you just put your papers there, and then it's a way of people, so that people can access them for free once they're out of like copyright or whatever.
Okay.
Or if you want to put them, you know, because you haven't published them or whatever, you can put them there as well. And just follow other people's. And it's a good way of, you know, meeting other colleagues and stuff like that.
Meeting other colleagues for networking.
Yeah. Sometimes, you know, if you're after a paper that you cannot find, or you want to know more about some results from an archaeological dig that aren't published yet, for example, you can get in touch with them.
Okay, because I've written a thesis as well. You're not the only one.
You mean your master's dissertation?
No, it's not it. It was an MPhil.
I was just waiting for you to say what it
was. Which is halfway between a master's and a PhD.
Is it not?
So you could actually convert your MPhil into a PhD.
Yeah, I know that.
Yeah, so...
Thank you very much.
Yeah. There's no space for being a snob in the park. So it's too pristine and pure. But okay. I generally never knew about that website, though. academia.whatedu.com.
What you do dot edu edu
edu all right
like edu,
it is a pretty good resource. So yes, that's pretty exciting. How many times have you been published?
I don't know, in total like 10 or 12.
That's pretty amazing though.
Well, it's all right. No, it was good. I mean, I don't know, it's getting published is really difficult in reality, so yeah, you have to appreciate when you manage to do it.
And the turnaround is, like, especially in academia, is very long, isn't it, for getting articles published?
Yeah, that's why now when things are turning like more towards digital publications, like, things are a lot better, you know, because the process is a lot faster and you don't need to go through all the printing, and it's cheaper and it's just more open to everybody. So that people like open access journals are far more popular now.
Yeah, JSTOR sort of lost their monopoly on everything then.
Well, there's been like a huge controversy like recently with Elsevier, for example, which is a very famous science like editorial publishing house, and they were basically making a lot of money out of the authors, and then the authors are not really making any money, but they're making a lot of money from charging people for accessing the journal. And it was just extortion, and it's come to a point where people just got too fed up, and they're basically saying, well, I'm taking off my paper, or I'm putting my paper open for everyone to download and stuff like that. And there's a real sort of like war on the web going on, trying to stop this
backlash.
Yeah. I mean, now a lot of people are saying, well, we've had enough of other people making money for our research, you know, which is fair enough. I mean,
well, the thing is, like, life in academia is pretty excruciating.
I think that's a good way of describing it.
Well, not to, you know, sit in the fence or anything, but no, but the thing is, like, now more than ever, it's very hard to get into it, and even when you are in it, you're expected to do a lot of work that's either unpaid or very badly paid, and it's not very financially rewarding, and it seems like a huge slog. And a lot of competition, obviously, for those permanent spots that are in university. So I think any reports I've seen or anecdotes from people involved in trying to get established with a permanent position in university, it's always been a tale of heartbreak and woe.
Yeah, it's one of the main destroyers of life, you know.
It's a strange system, though, because I think it's not really healthy, because some people really do spend their, like, entire, you know, formative years, and they're building their career in that university bubble, and it is a bubble, and I don't think it is really helpful, because people do turn weird sometimes.
Even though weird to start with.
Exactly. Like my brother, for example. Oh, the joys of recording outside.
You're trying to say your brother's weird?
No. I'm saying he's in Phil. And now he went off and published books, and now he's doing his PhD. So he took a break and did real life stuff as well. Traveled the world, got married, and all that kind of crack. But no, you don't have to get married, obviously, before you do your PhD. It's not a prerequisite. But my point is, I think you should definitely take a break, step back, and do other things before going back into it, because I think it's very easy to fall into that track of, like, just being in that university bubble, and I think you do lose a bit of perspective.
He's quite lucky to be able to do what he did, because taking a break, more often than not, just pushes you off the whole thing, you know?
Yeah.
So it's hard to do that, but, you know, fair play to him.
Well, it depends on what you're... Well, it depends on what your expectations are, or what you want to get out of it. if you want to get a job,
money.
Definitely don't stay in academia then. If you want a position in university, then yeah, it's probably very unlikely then that you would get it if you take a break. So you have to keep pushing. So that's a fair point. But I think if you want to be a professional historian or be a professional author, if you can lucky enough to support yourself through that, which is not always possible, but my brother is doing it. Or do other things and also publish a research on the side if that's possible as well, then I think you can take a break, and it's important as well, because also as well, the PhD is very, very long process of studying and researching, and it's a very emotionally taxing kind of like ride as well. So you've been in the position of being sensei, mentor to to PhD students in the past in Computenza University, or some university in Madrid.
you always get my university wrong.
So what are the things that you felt compelled to advise them about, to warn them about, the guidelines that you gave them? What was important for them to know about this path that they were about to take?
Well, you just have to be aware that it's a long process, and you know, you have to you have to be constant and disciplined, but also like you need to take it easy mentally, because it really puts a lot of stress into your life, and you just have to learn to manage it. I think that's probably one of the best things that I got out of the PhD, more than the actual degree, was just learning to manage stress and deadlines, and generally controlling the course of a very long project, because at the end of the day, it's like you're working for something like that is going to happen in like 4 years' time, so it's very easy to just let go and leave it all till the end or whatever, which of course doesn't work. So
That's what happened to a guy I went to university with. I used to live with him, and believe it or not, because I don't drink very much, he thought I was up myself, until he realised that the beer upset my tum-tum sometimes, and he goes, okay, fair enough, because that's what happens in Ireland. You need to have a genuine medical complaint before they even consider
that you don't drink.
Exactly, accepting it as a moral question. But that's what happened to him. He was doing a PhD on Samuel Beckett, or as someone said before, Samuel Beckett, because they weren't too enamoured with his works, even though he is a ledge of the old theatre writing. But yeah, he was definitely leaving go on the slide.
But it's just like, I'm sorry, but it's kind of like a bit like, it's a bit funny that you're doing a PhD on Samuel Beckett, and then in the end,
nothing happens.
He's like, he should have got distinction. He's marvelous. I mean, the guy's a genius.
If he had the Leo Rodi, if he had the stones to persist with it, and then in his thesis defense to say, yeah, nothing exactly happens, boom, Beckett. It would have been fantastic.
It would have been epic.
Waiting for Godot, waiting for your dissertation, my man. he's ridiculously well read. He knows a lot of like Milton and like medieval poetry and all these things. And okay, I remember we used to my other housemate who also lived with us, he set up a football website, a football blog, and he wrote one article comparing Ronaldo to the Greek character Narcissus, staring at his own reflection in the water, and it's filled with so many words I had never seen before, which is a very...
It must be good then.
It was amazing, yeah. If you can't understand it, it must be good. But yeah, so like he has it back on track now, but for a while he was definitely leaving it slide, and then that can really affect your well-being, because you're feeling under pressure to get things done. But also as well, it depends on your tutor, of course, because they're not always helpful, of course. But the thing is as well, like when I was in university, we had an officer for the student experience. He wasn't a student, he was just an employee of the university, and he said as well, like a lot of things you get out of university aren't necessarily academic related as well, so those things that you learn are transferable skills to the other parts of your life as well. So, and you know, did they ask any questions?
No, not really. I mean, that's the thing. I don't know. That well, I don't know. I would have appreciated having somebody to warn me about a lot of things that I found out by myself.
Yeah.
But then again, I suppose that's, you know, when you start, you're sort of like innocent. You don't know what you're getting into. Perhaps it's better that way, because otherwise it might put you off from doing it. You know.
The thing is, is that you know, the subjects that we've studied, history and politics, and in your case, archaeology, are sometimes the forgotten children of academia. I mean, I remember I did Greek and Roman in my first year of university. I think they sent letters to everybody, basically saying, "Hey, please come back for a second year." That's just the GPS in the background. See, that's technology saying. This is what I think of your humanities and your history and all your other subjects like that. Give me an engineer any day of the week. But yeah, so like, they were obviously desperately looking for students because they had lost students. They, you know, there's a real threat that they would close down as a department and they wouldn't be able to run anymore because it wouldn't be viable. But as a PhD student, in a subject like that, you really are fighting. Not only are you, you know, doing for personal things, as in getting a PhD and maybe contributing to the wider knowledge, of course, because as you mentioned earlier, that academic website, but you are really keeping it alive. And going back to previous topics in other podcasts, it's like a speaker of a language that isn't living or as vibrant as other languages, like by the sheer act of living it and speaking it, you're keeping it alive. And by being a PhD student in this field, you really are kind of keeping it alive as well. So, I mean, did you ever get a sense of that when you were doing the PhD, that you were part of the fabric of making it a living thing, and maybe even feeling some kind of pressure associated with that as well?
Well, for me, that's the only thing that really made it worthwhile, the fact that I knew for a fact, well, obviously everybody that has a PhD is supposed to be bringing in something new, but some of them are just a different take or whatever, but what I was doing, what I was recording, I knew for a fact it never been done before. And also, like, it had a social importance, you know, because, like, recording like traditional architecture in Egypt, traditional ways of life that were disappearing, was important for the people that lived in those houses. So that was the most rewarding thing for me, that it actually, what I did, although ultimately the aim was archaeology oriented, the actual data collection and all that actually helps put some people on the map. That was, for me, that was important.
You put people on the map?
Well, you know, just because, like, they're very abandoned, apart from being very poor, they're just, they consider, like, poor country bumpkins, not part of the fabric of the country, so it was just nice to be able to record the culture.
That's good. In fact, I always reminded of my thesis, my MPhil, before you say anything, today, because I listened to a BBC podcast about the Ethiopia and Eritrea war finally coming to an end, and there being flights between the countries, people being reunited, phone calls being done between the two countries as well, because the phone lines were blocked as well. You had stories of people flying to other countries to phone people in either Ethiopia or Eritrea, for example. But one of my chapters, so I divided my MPhil into different chapters. One was focused on the United Nations, and in 2001, Ireland had a seat on the Security Council, which had, you know, they were able to pin Britain and America to certain human rights standards before they invaded, went on their invasion round that year. But also as well, they played a fundamental part, Irish diplomats and Irish human rights advocates in the government, in kind of maintaining the ceasefire between Ethiopia and Eritrea in that year as well. So it's kind of like an example of how, you know, conflicts big and small, Ireland's been able to kind of play a part in keeping the peace. So there, well, I didn't put anybody on the map, but
still, well, no, I mean, that's, you know, it's still a very significant work. I mean, there are things that, I don't know, in the end, like, social sciences, apart from, like, research, are about making a difference, I think, you know, in, like, actual living populations. So no, that's fantastic when you when what you do can actually have an impact, or what you're studying is the impact that some people can still play, you know. So
Did you get in trouble for writing too creatively in your thesis?
At the beginning, I did actually, because the way you write in Spanish and in English is very different. And in Spanish, it's a sign of like a good writer, a good academic writer, to actually, be very, I wouldn't say redundant, but to, you know, go be around the bushes for a long time, trying to explain the idea rather than going to the point, you know. It's actually like, I mean, you have to be clear, but the more kind of like adorned grammatically, the better. And at first I had some problems with that because I just made it too complicated, when in English it's far more like, you know, ABC.
That's very true. My tutor told me that you can do that Stieg Larsson stuff when you're finished. But while you're in here, son, Sonny Jim, you write a bit more academically.
Yeah.
So, you know. But yeah, the joys of it. So,
it's a creativity killer, you know. PhD.
Yeah, it is a little bit. But I think it's always fun as well to work in certain flourishes wherever you can. We can get away with them. Normally in the acknowledgements.
Yes. Which is basically the only space where you can have a license for that.
Oh, exactly. So, yeah, that's a lot of interesting stuff about academia. So, best luck with your publishing career. I look forward. I watch this space. I'll be looking forward for your academic articles on mud brick houses in the future.
Yes.
So, watch this space. Someone's going to be a supernova star in the academia world. Okay, so I hope you enjoyed that little bitine of music between the first section of part 2, and this is the final section of part 2 before we go into part 3. So there's been moves aplenty. So on previous podcasts, we referred to the Pepe scandal, the fall of the government, basically. But now, there's a new leader. Enter the man, the myth, the Casado.
Well, this guy... Well, I don't know if he's intelligent, but I don't think he is, to be honest. But he's clever in that he knows how to position himself.
Yes.
Which I think he's a bit of a hanger-on.
And they all.
And he basically... Yeah, I mean, he's a guy from like a small like provincial town, and he's just been climbing his way up. I'm not entirely sure through whether legit methods or not.
Now, this is a shift to the right for Pepe. Now, Pepe are already on the right, but this is a shift even more along the right spectrum.
Yeah.
One of the things he has proposed is perhaps rolling back the abortion law and making abortion, based on the 1985 code?
Mm-hmm.
Now, what is the 1985 code?
Well, I mean, before it was just it was just like not allowed. Basically, the only circumstances could be like serious danger for the mother or the baby, or basically like very strict medical reasons that had to be justified.
Okay, I think a few people that I've spoken to are shocked, I think, by this, because it seems like such a regressive move for a modern country like Spain, because Pepe, as I said, have always been right, and you can have different leaders that will shift it maybe a little bit more left, a little bit more centre, or a little bit more right, but this seems like quite a drastic measure. Do you think this will actually go through?
Well, I mean, this is like just part of his programme, the same as the euthanasia.
Yeah.
Because he wants to make it even more restrictive. But I think he's just want to appeal to a whole lot of like Pepe voters that were like disenchanted because that kind of turned more centered.
Yeah,
in a way.
Yeah,
you know?
I understand that, but like for me, right, looking at Pepe, for me, their big issues are just three things: the corruption scandal, obviously, which brought down the government,
yeah,
Catalonia, and then the economy. So those are the three things that I would have thought that for a Pepe leader, that they would have to be seen to be taking a position on those things, that, and that's what would garner more support rather than something that's a little bit, you know, left field perhaps, because this wasn't part of the public conversation before he was elected, really. So
yes, but I think it's like pure strategy, because what he's trying to do is to like gain more of the right voters, and a lot of people that were conservative it's not just about the finances, it's also about like the ethical issues, and he's just trying to win those people back. A lot of them are like elderly voters,
yeah,
that actually are like a huge proportion of the party. But that, how can I explain it? Yes, there's corruption and all that, but you know, if they have to choose between corruption or the values that they believe should prevail in Spain, then they will choose the values. You know what I mean? It's kind of like, it's a bit of a paradox, but that's how it works.
No, I understand. It's a big gamble, though. Again, it's not that surprising, because you very often do see conservative leaders banking on what they're doing to garner support from their core followers, and then they don't care if they alienate other people in the country or even internationally. I mean, look at Berlusconi, for example, or even Putin. The things that they've done have kept their core support happy, but have really annoyed people domestically and abroad as well. So I think that's, that international dimension is probably a factor, or will be a factor, because, I mean, look at New Zealand, for example. The other day, they passed a law which gave people leave if they were victims of domestic abuse, for example. Ireland passed the abortion law. So this whole Me Too movement, these very kind of progressive things that are happening internationally, and to kind of take a position that's so at odds with the international discourse takes a lot of stones as well, I think. I don't mean that in a praising way, but it's a big gamble as well, I think.
Well, but I think, I don't know, somebody pointed out something interesting, saying that, you know, the more progressive movements there are, the more reactionary movements there are in response, you know what
that,
I mean?
So, that's very true, because more Alcoholic Anonymous can be found in Ireland.
So, you know, that's how it works. So some people actually get very scared of changes and of things that they perceive as the world that they know changing, and them losing their essence or whatever, you know? There's a real problem with identifying.
But like, do you think Pepe are going to adopt the strategies of other parties that have tapped into that? Because, you know, you need to mobilize even young people that feel affected by that, and that transfers to even other issues like immigration, maybe, or lack of jobs. You need to be very competent with social media, and I don't think Pepe are kind of garnering support through social media or tapping into that the way other people who've done what he wants to do have done through that medium,
yeah.
You know.
Well, I think that's what they're trying to do, even if it's just with the image of a young guy and one who is like similar or very similar to Ciudadanos, which is the party that is trying to steal voters from them, you know. So I think they're just trying to give, and also to give an image of like new, you know, a new atmosphere for the party. That's why they've picked somebody, because in reality the members of the party voted between the two candidates, and they chose the other candidate. They didn't choose him.
Yeah,
he wasn't the one that got the most votes, but from the members. But then, according to their own rules, after the members vote, they have like a party committee vote, and even though the people had preferred the other woman, their own party, you know.
Yeah, but
the party committee decided to go for him.
But for example, if they want to give a fresh image, surely, well, I know like they've had prominent female politicians before, but having someone, a new female leader, would have probably tapped into that as well, no? Giving the place a fresh air or a sense of change and newness.
To be honest, I have a bit of a theory about the whole thing, because the reason why, this is my personal opinion, it might sound very like conspiracy theory, like, but I think, you know, the reason why Rajoy worked was because he was a bit of a puppet. That's why he worked for so long, because he could be managed by all the people that I don't know exactly who they are, but there's obviously some people in the Conservative Party that are very powerful,
yeah.
And they're the ones that really move the strings. And they could do that easily with Rajoy, and I think with Casado they can do it easily as well, because superficially he seems, you know, very, very modern, very forward, all that, but I think he's made his way up through kind of like, you know, bothering people and stuff like that. So
yeah.
I think they can mold him into whatever they want. I think that's what they're going for, really.
Well, we'll see how that works out, because I think one thing that Rajoy had in his favour, and this was actually a big disadvantage, was that he had a very he had a proclivity for putting his foot in his mouth and saying stupid things. But if you have an idiot like that, or well, not an idiot perhaps, but somebody who is prone to a gaffe or an embarrassment, you know, it kind of helps that along a little bit. No, you have somebody who takes a lot of flack, and then behind the scenes people can kind of pull the strings, as you say. But it's going to be determined whether this person will attract the attention like in that way, and if he doesn't, will that dynamic still function in the party? I don't know.
Well, yeah, but I mean, you have to think that this guy, from the start, he's already been investigated for his master's.
Oh, yeah, I've seen
he's like, already been for
yeah.
the same as we talked about.
Steve Fuentes.
Yeah, we talked about the president of Madrid before, and he's the same. He did the same master's, he didn't go to class either,
yeah.
And still he got the degree. So, I mean, it's not a great start, really, and he hasn't. The judge still like all it in evidence, so you know it's not really the greatest start for somebody, the president of a party. So it's also yet to be seen how long he's actually going to last.
Yeah, well, if he is turfed out then because of this court ruling or whatever, it's gonna be a huge image or PR disaster for Pepe.
Yeah, they should have thought of that as well, you know. But well, they will have the reasons. But I always get the impression there's a huge like power struggle within the party.
Yeah, but the thing, yeah, well, in most parties, I assume there is, but like, I think as well, you said that he wants to get in touch with the core voters or kind of win people back. But having such an obvious example of going against the popular vote of their own party and then going to the committee is, again, it's another example of a contradiction, no? And it remains to be seen whether people will accept it or go along with it. But what's your feeling? Are people a little put out by this voting in, you know?
I don't think so, because the thing that I always observe about the Conservative Party in Spain is that they have like this discipline that I find a bit scary, to be honest. But you know, even if they disagree or whatever, in the end it's like a authoritarian
ranks.
Father or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
they're still like they won't let others like see their weaknesses, and they will all like just stick together and pretend everything is fine, you know?
Yeah.
And that's how they've resisted for so long. I mean,
because Podemos have aired their dirty laundry.
The problem that the left has is that they start historically in Spain, like they always start breaking up over internal issues, while the right just holds together. They might hate themselves, or they might have like these enormous power struggles, but they won't, you know, let
yeah.
that show. As much as they can. So.
But the right are in general are crafty anyway. they are, because like there's a couple of stories in the media this week of comedians who've been cut out because like conservative groups have basically trawled through their Twitter or their social media accounts. No, in America. Mm-hmm. For the listeners who couldn't see that, was pointing at the floor of the car, which I think represented
here in my car.
Your car in Spain and Spain are clear of that, I think. Two great territories. No, in America, and like some of the things that they unearthed like are not really very nice, but the fact that there's a culture there of crazy drivers there. So
it wasn't necessary.
Don't worry, all part of the magic of the podcast. But no, like, so some of the things that they've unearthed, and like Dan Harmon, for example, has been caught up in this as well, have been a little bit unpleasant. But the fact that there's a whole culture out there of conservatives and right wingers kind of like looking for dirt on liberals, it's a real international problem. So I think they're crafty. They're craftier and more ring savvy in the left, unfortunately, but and they're not afraid of using dirty tactics. But I don't know. I think it's going to trudge on, isn't it? I mean, even though we're talking about this, it's going to, you know, the people who are Pepe supporters are going to be Pepe supporters. And it's very hard to shake that out of them. And then you've got the people who are Ciudadanos or Podemos. And even though things change, people are already really set in their lines, no?
Even more so in the right, I think.
Yeah,
I think they're less changeable.
Yeah, I think that's just true in a lot of countries as well. Okay, so it's been how better to celebrate the summer than to talk about academia
and politics
and politics. So yeah, so thank you so much for staying tuned for this part two and this car journey full of spills, trills and blowing klaxons, and we'll be talking to you momentarily in part three. So, welcome to part three. We have a wonderful view of the city, and lots of trees. It's a very well cultivated park, so props to the gardener. I think you should put on record as well your thanks to the gardener, or the gardening team.
Well, thank you to the gardening team.
Excellent, that's very, very sincere.
There must be a few, I mean.
So we're off to actually go on this free train. It's going to go on a huge loop around the park, and the destinations we're going to see, we're going to enjoy.
Different part of the, there's no names, I don't know. It's just like there's like huge sculptures all over the place.
That's very true. We're going to see a huge auditorium as well.
Yeah, that's true.
That's true. So you know what? It's the summer, so we're going to go. My taxi's waiting. Your Uber is ready to take you north first. Where's this out first? Get your bags packed. So thank you so much for following us for the last season and for longer if you have been a long time listener. You can find us now on Player FM as well. We've been rebooted on that platform. Find us on all the usual places. LRPmedia.com is our website, Instagram, YouTube, Patreon, Google Circles or whatever the hell it is. We're there as well. Google Plus, that's the
Circles
one.
Circles and Squares.
So you can find us on all those spots. So enjoy your summer holidays. We will be back in 2 weeks, rejuvenated, recuperated, ready for another season of barnstorming, brain tickling, cultural chit chat based on things in and outside Madrid. So Mary, sign us off there.
People will talk.
People will talk. For more buzzwords and slogans from our back catalogue, tune in for season 6, debuting in 2 weeks. Thank you so much. Good luck.
Thank you. Bye.
The El Arpa Podcast, the home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk.